Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
May 22nd, 2016, episode number 95, Hitching a Ride. Hello, one and all, Kevin England here with our latest installment of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Spring is in full swing here in New Jersey. The initial blooms have abated some, but the spring plants are still on a roll and hives look happy and in full operation from what I can tell. It's still been that mix of cool and rainy with warm weather and cool weather. We haven't hit that steady stride of nice warm weather and warm nights yet. It's been 3 weeks since we last had a chance to report. And for this episode, I'm back to my regular format, and thanks for hanging in after that extended local hive report of last episode, if that wasn't your cup of tea. I have a pretty big episode to go through, so let me tell you what's in store and get things going. Varroa mites riding on bees, an interesting twist to the impact to said bees. A preview on the basics of queen rearing methods. Carpenter bees, how to talk to homeowners about them. An update on our hive monitoring system aspirations for the association. I'll share with you a recap of a swarm capture that took place yesterday. A shot in the arm for the New Jersey Swarm Report. A checkerboard hive paint scheme too cool. And an idea on a fitness challenge fit for life and building a habit for a strong core for beekeeping in life. That's what we have coming up, but before I get started, I wanted to share my email address in case you wanted to write in, kevin@bkcorner.org. I talk about our website and our YouTube channel enough that I'll forego those as I want to get down to business tonight. You might hear them somewhere in the episode, so let's jump in how we always get started, the Local Hive Report. Local Hive Report, I have 8 hives in operation and I'll run through them fairly quickly this week. 2 are in the yard outside, the 3-deep Langstroth hive and an 8-frame are both hopping, just bees pouring out of them all day long. The Langstroth 10-frame is on a hive scale and I can't recall the last weight from last weekend, but I know it was 267 this weekend. That means one of two things to me. You see, I can't recall if the previous weight was 265 or the last reading was 275. I shot a video somewhere on my phone or on my video camera, on my GoPro, I don't remember which, and I've been trying to make sure that I record them, but I didn't get back to it, and I don't know where the video is. I lost track of it. So if on Saturday it weighed 267, that means it either gained 2 pounds or it lost 8. My guess is that if it's found to have lost weight after I put the numbers together, that it likely swarmed. But if you recall, I pulled a box out of this hive and made a split with it, and then I gave it additional space. So I'm hoping that's not the case and I have it wrong, and that it just gained 2 pounds. So I'll find my notes somewhere and collate, and if I can remember, I'll bring that to you next week. The 8-frame, it ate all of the sugar solution I gave it. I put a feeder up on top, and that's all I know about it. I did mix up some more sugar solution, but didn't get a chance to get out there and put it on there, so it's just getting whatever it can find in nature. Moving to the farm. I looked at the polystyrene hive at some point during the week and noticed that it has 2 deeps and 2 mediums coming out of winter, and the top mediums are just loaded, packed full with honey. So in order to keep it from swarming and to give them additional room, I put 2 more honey boxes on it. I didn't want to mess around. I didn't have a smoker when I did it. So I just popped the cover off and put 2 boxes right on top. And then put the cover back on. And my guess is they're working that. I did put an emery shim in between them. And I could see when I was over there today that the bees are using it as a top entrance. And the hive is just hammering, which is good to go. As far as the rest of the hives down the stack, one of them behind that is a conventional Langstroth. Made a split. And I did not look at it. I have no idea. I could see stuff coming and going. I'm assuming it's working. That hive should probably be fed, but I didn't feed it yet. Behind that is the Waray hive. Found a problem with the Waray hive. Went and took a look at it. I could see that they built out about 5 or 6 frames. And the comb hanging looks great. But I noticed there wasn't that many bees, considering how big the package was that I put in it. And lo and behold, Danny was with me, and he looked at the bottom, and there were all these dead bees lined up on the bottom of the bottom board. So my speculation is it's been so cold at night that these bees froze or could not maintain the heat and keep them on the cluster. And I made a mistake when I put this hive in, but I watched a video of this hive being installed by others. And the speculation was that the Waray hive, the form factor is a little bit smaller than a Langstroth, and they should be able to keep it warm. I should have known better. I thought about it when I did it, and I just went there and stayed with it. Siri thinks I'm talking to her. Yes, everyone, I bought an iPhone, believe it or not. I'm not talking to you, Siri. Go back to sleep. So here's what I did. I took the spare boxes out from underneath. And I just collapsed it down to one box. And I peeked at it today, and it looks to be about the same. It's not growing. Again, I didn't feed this. I'm assuming that it has full nectar available to it. But I think what I'm going to do is try and figure out next week, when I get a break, how to feed this hive. It's the best thing to do for it, since they have a half a cluster size. Going behind that, the top bar is probably in the same shape. I looked at it. Don't see a lot of bees coming and going. And this one I did put a feeder on, and for whatever reason, they didn't eat much of it. I saw the bees up in the feeder today, but there's still a lot of sugar water for them to take. So we'll see what happens with this hive. One thing I did not feed either one of these is a pollen patty, and I have them. And I think next time I go in them, when I get some time, I'm going to do that. Behind that is another Langstroth hive. It's doing fine. Behind that is another Langstroth hive. It's one of the splits. It's the it's the all medium hive. I looked in there. That hive is doing okay. And then I'll talk about a swarm I captured that I mentioned on the outro. That's in a single deep. So, it's one of those times where I'm so busy I can't get in them, and bees will fend for themselves, and that's what they're going to do until this weekend when I can get in there. So that's the local hive report. I wish I had a little more time to go look at some of these splits and see if they're raising queens, but on another side of me is saying this is good because I don't want to be messing around in these boxes. I'm assuming they raised a queen, and that the queen is out getting mated and doing her thing. And when I go back in there, I'll be able to see progress and start to see eggs and so on. In the all medium hive stack, I did look and I saw the queen cells were hatched. I didn't find the queen. She could have been out mating. But I also didn't dig through the box. Again, I'm trying not to disturb them and leave them be more so. You can't tell if a box is operational by what's coming and going, but in this case, I put them all in a good position, and I'm assuming that they're going to be okay and good to go. So there you go. That's the local hive report. I probably go in a little more detailed next weekend when I have some time. I'll break these hives out and go see what they're doing. I have a notion somewhere along the line before I leave that I want to pull a couple frames out and make a nuke out of something. I guess I'll get to that in the next episode. So local hive report done. Check. Things are okay. Let's go ahead and head into segment number one. Segment number one, hitching a ride. For the first segment of this episode, I want to start with a feature on Varroa mite biology and the continued quest to understand our foe. We all know that the mite spends its time in the cell with bees that are in incubation, but there are times when the mite is found hanging off of a bee. This part of a mite's life cycle, where they're hitching a ride on a bee, is called the phoretic phase. In a recent study, scientists researched an angle that you might not readily think of, but it paid off with an interesting insight about varroa mites. The research comes from a study released April 20th, 2016, entitled Impact of the Phoretic Phase on Reproduction and Damage Caused by Varroa Destructor to its Host, the European Honeybee. This is a study that was published on PLOS One. The study was focused on the impact of the varroa mite on future generations of bees when it's hanging on to its host for a longer duration of time versus a short ride or no ride at all, and then subsequently into the cell where it is going to be with the bee that incubates. The length of a time a mite spends on a bee can vary. In the study, it indicated it could be 1 to 10 days or more. And that's the area of interest. What was the impact to the bee when the mite was there longer? Sometimes the mite just hops on a nurse bee to get a ride right into the brood chamber, but sometimes it's hanging around. And the question is, does the length of the mite hitching a ride have any impact on the delivery of virus loads of the phoretic host or the generations of mites that will be with the larvae from this mother mite? What I'm talking about here is the mite itself, not only the impact to the bee, but the actual mite that is attached to the bee and then goes into the cell. Is there any impact from it hitching a ride longer? So before I go, the term phoretic keeps coming up. May not be one you're familiar with. We've covered it before, but a reminder of what it means might be welcome. Phoretic means an association of two organisms in which one, say the varroa mite, travels on the body of another without being a parasite. That definition is a general one, and as we know, the varroa mite is indeed a parasite, meaning it benefits by deriving nutrients at the host's expense. So let me tell you about this experiment, the particulars as provided from the study. It was carried out in the south of France in August through September 2014. 8 Buckfast honeybee colonies were maintained on an INU university campus in Albi, France. They were left untreated so that the varroa infestation remained high throughout the season. The objective was to rear mites in controlled conditions, allowing the performance of the experiments. For the experiments, they used 5.6 millimeter diameter gelatin capsules following the work of researchers Nazzi and Milani, who developed a technique for reproducing varroa jacobsoni under laboratory conditions. Holes were pierced in the top half of the cap of the gelatin capsule using a thin needle for ventilation. A brood frame was brought back to the laboratory, and open capsules were stuck into the cells that were not capped yet of their early spinning larvae. The frame was then placed for about 3 hours in an incubator at 35 degrees Celsius, 60% relative humidity, with the top of the brood cells facing the ground, and the larvae slowly slid into the gelatin capsules. One mite was then transferred onto each larvae less than 5 hours after the initiation of spinning and the capsules were closed. Prior to their use, the mites were submitted to a phoretic phase in laboratory conditions. 7-day-old adult bees were taken back from the hive and presented with random sampled parasites from a hive brood frame for the mites to ride on. Host and parasites were kept in experimental cages at 35 degrees Celsius, 60% relative humidity, for 3 days to 1 week before transfer of the mites on the larvae. Once the mite had been introduced, the gelatin capsule was immediately closed, and these artificial cells were kept in incubators 35 degrees Celsius, 80% relative humidity until the completed bee development, which was about 11 days later. This protocol was developed in this laboratory and tested for reproducibility and relevance was a prerequisite as it defined a controlled environment to study the influence of different factors, such as the length and type of bees used during the phoretic phase. And it can be noted that other scientists came up with this gel capsule method, and they are following it, advancing the work done from those before. So now that you know how they designed the study to mimic natural conditions of a mite riding on a bee, put it in a laboratory, let's talk about what they learned. First off, the study was about what is the impact of the mites on the bee, but it's also about the experiment to set the mites up on the bee and how that went. They shared a note in the body of the study that they were satisfied by the outcome, as the rearing success was validated by the proportions of reproductive mothers and numbers of fully molted daughters of the mites, similar to previous conditions documented in previous studies. So let me say what that meant. They followed the reproductive cycle of varroa mite previously, and they have several cases documented so they know what happens with a mother and her offspring. Here they created this artificial capsule-based delivery of it, and what they found out is that afterwards the same reproductive cycle for the mite occurred as it would have in the previous studies that were documented. So that's good. That worked out for them. So, of course, during the study, they had to monitor the mite and its health and well-being to see how it reacted throughout the study. One of the things they did during the study is to monitor the vitellogenin levels of the mites, as it is key to the reproductive process of varroa. Remember, they're looking for the impact of varroa on the bee. But if you could find something that can be used against the varroa, then you have to take in the big picture and look at the varroa and the bee. The results showed that the vitellogenin levels are different, are a differentiator for the varroa when they have the chance to have a phoretic stage on a bee. I'll translate to say that my interpretation is that the varroa is more of a varroa because they went through a stage of being a parasite on a bee. That is to be thought of in contrast to as if they had an offspring and the offspring hatched in a cell, it walked around inside the hive, and then it went right into another cell with no time spent on a bee. So the point of this little sidebar is that vitellogenin is a protein that plays a key role in the development of an insect, bees included, but here we're talking about mites, and it appears to be affected for the varroa by the time it spends riding on a bee. The study says that, quote, interestingly, it would support the idea that newly born female mites need a phoretic phase to complete their maturation of their reproductive organs, end quote, and that, quote, in such a context, only the first phoretic phase in the parasite life would be essential to the mites, end quote. It goes on to say that some studies in the past have downplayed the stage where the mite was on the bee, but this study seems to be saying or indicating that it could be more important than once thought. This one says, quote, to date, results from several studies, including ours, have pointed out the subsequent negligible importance of the phoretic phase in the reproduction of mature females, end quote. So as somebody following the study, I look at that in terms of our treatment options. We will always talk about the treatments that get the mite in the cell, because that's where we want to get them, right? But here we have a notion that even the treatments that are zapping the mites that are in the phoretic stage, the ones that hitch a ride on a bee, could change the equation of how impactful mites are to bees. Now, of course, if you kill a mite on a bee, the bee survives, or the bee suffers, and the mite dies, and it doesn't raise any young. But, you know, all interesting stuff here. So, yeah, what about the bee? Tell me about the bee in this study. So let's start with the end in mind. Mites that had a longer phoretic phase on the bee led to more deformations? How do you say that word? Deformations. So the conclusion of the study is that the varroa mites that went through a long phoretic phase frequently induced more malformities on the new adults than in times when the mite had a short-term phoretic parasite phase. Was there a short period of time versus a long time? It had more impact when it was there longer. How, you might ask? Varroa destructor induces more wing deformity in emerging honeybees when it has experienced a longer phoretic phase because of the deformed wing virus transmission that it's carrying down the line. Of course, the impact of a higher dose there is either because the newly born bee cannot emerge out of the cell because it's so sick, or because it's thrown out of the hive by the worker bees. The malformations often lead to an early death, as the correlation between deformity and death found in the study suggests. So in addition to what I just told you, they speculated that this phenomena could be intensified in an untreated overwintering hive where the mites had to go through a long phoretic period because of the absence of the brood. For the first time, the damage to the bees has been linked to the length of the phoretic phase, which should be taken into account when managing queenless beehives highly infested with varroa, for instance. How about that? If the bees are in there, and they're in there for a long time, and they have mites riding on them, they could be sicker than... Yeah, that's an interesting notion. So this research opens new avenues for understanding the host-parasite interaction, I think. And it becomes apparent when you look at the work before it, often cited in this research paper, that it builds on what they know and could lead later to investigate new possible biological controls for methods of this pest and focus on trying to get the phoretic mites off the bees in a shorter duration as a possible outcome. In the end, I suppose it's not terribly surprising to make the connection that the longer the mite is on the bee, the more damage it can inflict. You would think that once a virus is vectored, how much worse could it get? But apparently, longer is not better in our case. So as is customary with our episodes, we will have a link to this journal article in our show notes. To visit our show notes, go to www.bkcorner.org. Look for episode number 95 in the show notes and you'll see it. For those of you that are new to the podcast, you can go and look up any episode. Typically, the segments are listed by time, so you can figure out which segment you want and also find the links below in each of the show note episodes. Segment number 2, queen rearing techniques. I've always wanted to do this topic. Tried a couple times at it and never could find the time to put it all together. And recently, I just bit the bullet. When I'm talking about queen rearing techniques, mind you, I have no experience at this. And it was a topic I put together for the presentation at our beekeepers meeting recently. And what I wanted to talk about is things like the Doolittle method and the Hopkins method and the Miller method and all of these ways that people raise queens. I don't know a lot of people who do this type of work, but I've always been curious about how it works and how it came out. And I know there's queen rearing courses. I've never had the chance yet to sit in on one. So before I start, I'm going to give credit where credit is due. I'm Michael Bush, amazing guy, all the work he's done for beekeepers, and a treasure trove of information in looking at queen rearing methods. Michael's work and information is second to none, I would say. I also took a look at Colossus Honeybee Research Association. This had a queen rearing step through that give you the basics. And I'm going to call out a YouTube video that I thought, and I looked at a bunch of them, Bill Weinerth. On his channel, he had raising queen bees, and there was a step-by-step process, and I'll post a link to his video that I thought was great. One of the things I was looking for is how do they make wax queen cups, and he had a method for doing that, and I won't get ahead of myself. I'll get to him in a little bit, but let me go ahead and tell you some of the things I found. So first things first, just a fundamental principle. Where do queens come from? They come from fertilized eggs. Same as a worker bee, the same egg, but not the drones, because drones aren't fertilized, of course. The basic premise of raising queens are take newly hatched worker eggs. On day four, when they turn to a larvae, put them in a queenless hive. And if you give them nurse bees, believing that they need a queen for the colony, they'll make queens for you. And there's a number of ways to go about that, setting up that situation, and that's primarily what this will be about. So if you think about it, why in nature does a colony need a queen? Maybe they're preparing to swarm. It's that time of year. Maybe they want to supersede a failing queen. When the colony is queenless for some reason, such as an accident to the queen, they need to raise a new one. There's other reasons possibly, but they're the three that I could think of off the top of my head. And beekeepers like to take advantage of that. So back in the day, and I'm saying way back in the day, back as far as the 1500s, they knew about this. They didn't fully understand how queens got mated and all of these things until later times, but different folks, Nicola Jacobus, published that workers could raise a new queen from young worker larvae in 1568. That tells you how far back it goes. And other things that I found on Michael Bush's page related to this is 1767, Sherat performed a graft with works of 3 or 4 day old larvae and never with the simple eggs. I'm assuming that's how you say the name. I look at it and it looks like sriracha to me. It's S-C-H-I-R-A-C-H. In 1789, Huber described how with some worker eggs and a hive deprived of a queen, they enlarged the bees and converted to royal cells. Going further, modern queen rearing techniques started in the 19th century, and as Michael Bush points out, Gilbert Doolittle was the one given all the credit for it. But apparently he wasn't the one that developed it, he was the first one that wrote it down. And Doolittle demonstrated a comprehensive method, which is the basis of a lot of what the techniques are that are in use to today. In 1911, Isaac Hopkins wrote it out also. He apparently knew this back to 1886. And C.C. Miller also did some work in 1911, and I saw some things and read through it, but I don't want to go into that. Let's just keep moving on. But you get the gist here is that way back when, these guys figured this all out, and we've been riding on their coattails for a long time. I'll start with this notion. I don't think after what you hear, what I have to say, you'll be able to go out and raise queens, but maybe you will. But the fact of the matter is, I go back to some words of wisdom from Carly Toth in one of his presentations to us, is when is the best time to raise queens? For us in New Jersey, right now. Meaning, it's springtime. The nectar flow is on. The trees are in bloom. The plants are in bloom. Pollen is in abundance. And there are a plethora of bees coming out of winter. These are the things you need in order for the colony to be situated to raise a good queen. You also need to be in that period of year where you have enough drones, of course, because they need to be mated. So his words of wisdom are, when do you do it? You do it when the bees would do it. And in the premise of the bees building a colony for preparation for swarm and they're building queen cells, that's a perfect time for you to take advantage of queen rearing. Now, that's not to say that you can't do it later, but this is the time. Now, I'm going to go on a Kevin moment for a second. It's been a really cool spring here in New Jersey. We've had cool nights. You know, my notions back earlier in the year when I talked about making early splits and things like that, I did make splits a couple weeks ago, far later than I had planned. And they're just hanging on. They're not really going very well. And the reason is, you know, we've had a couple 70-degree days here and there. But it's not been overly warm. We've had some rain, but it's been cool nights. And I think they really need the warmth to be able to operate all the time and keep the cluster warm and build wax and have a big brood chamber and things like that. So anyway, end of that, Kevin, moment. Let me keep going on the topic at hand. So I'm going to start with a description of one of the methods I found from Michael's website, which is the alley method. You take a frame, pull it out of a hive. It has eggs and larvae. And you take a penknife or some sort of cutting implement, and you literally cut one row out. I saw a video of somebody who did this. They took a knife and they sliced all the way through, and then they literally cut each cell with an egg or larvae in it, and they mounted that in a cup. In this case, what he's proposing, Ali, is that you cut that strip out, and then you take a blunt instrument. You could use a match, for example, and you go into every other cell in the strip and you extinguish the egg or larvae and get rid of it. So now what you have is every other cell has an egg or larvae, and you take this little strip and you turn it from the cells facing you to the cells facing down. And using wax, you affix it to a board or the bottom of a hive frame that has the bottom cut out, and so that the cells are hanging down. And ideally, that space that you're connecting it to, why it's better to do this with wax than on a flat board, has a little bit of a curve. And that curve allows the right spacing for the peanut-shaped queen cell to be there, and it looks like, if you spread your fingers, it looks like your fingers, instead of straight, it has a little bit of a spread hand look to it. Very neat idea. Very simple, very straightforward, not very complicated. Not very complicated except for one part. You have to pick the right aged eggs and larvae. So you want larvae, eggs that are 3 days old and hatch into a larvae, and you want to pick them up on that fourth day, they make the best queens. So how do you know? If I handed you a frame and said, look at this, and you looked across and go, oh, these eggs, that one's 4 days old, how would you know? Well, they have a solution for that. The solution for that is the Hopkins method. You place a frame of dark comb that has no eggs, no anything, in the middle of a brood chamber, and you put the queen on it, and then you take a wire cage with number 5 hardware cloth, and you put it over top and confine the queen to the face. And the 5 hardware cloth keeps her from getting out, but they can get in and feed her and take care of her. And so she'll lay in that space, and you can then count the days, 1, 2, 3, 4, take the cage off, put the queen back in the hive, cut that section out, and use it to raise your new queens. Simple, but ingenious, right? The key here is, by restraining the queen, you are assured that the material that you're going to use to raise your queen is the right age. And this applies for the technique that I just told you about, where you could cut out the row and affix it, or for scooping them out and grafting. So back to Doolittle, the grafting method is where you use this little tool. And what I know about these tools is you can buy them off the internet, and people profess that one is better than another. To me, they look like dental instruments. And I can understand the finesse and the feel of these things. But in essence, they're like a little ice cream scooper in miniature. And it goes down inside the cell, and you use it to scoop the royal jelly and the larvae, and you take it and you put it in a cup to be used to raise a queen. So people buy these fancy tools. You could buy them in Bee Supplies, or you can order them from Japan or whatever. And I've also seen people who take something akin to a paper clip, and they pound it flat, and they make a shape, and they use a paper clip for the same purpose. So to each his own, I suppose. So you're going to take this larvae, and you're going to scoop the royal jelly and the larvae, and you're going to place it in a cup. If you've ever looked through a beekeeping catalog, you've seen these. Sometimes they sell kits with plastic cups, or people make them out of wax. It's the wax thing that brings us back to the video I mentioned in the opening, and the way that the guy made them. And I've seen other ways that people make them, but this guy's was the coolest, I thought. It has a separate bar, like a one inch by 1 inch bar. And in it, he's drilled holes and he's placed dowels at an interval where they're wide enough, probably about 1.5 inches, 2 inches apart. These are 3/8 inch dowels, and they're polished and rounded on the corners, and then they're soaked in water. And the reason you soak them is that when you dip them in wax, the wax will come off. Otherwise, it would stick to the wood. And I've also seen and read that people use soapy water to help as a release agent to get the wax off. So this guy has a bar that he's holding, and he dips it in a vat of wax. And the way that he has the wax, which looked a little dangerous to me, but it worked for him, he has this tub that he uses, and my guess is this thing is for spackle. It was made of metal, and he had wax in it. If you've ever done spackle where you used a wide knife to go across the joint, they sell these in the store. The one that I have is plastic with a metal rim, but sometimes you can buy them all out of metal. He had one of those sitting on two burners with the burners turned on gas underneath, and he had melted wax. And he takes his contraption and he dips it in the wax and he dips it in the wax and he dips it in the wax until it builds up a little bit of wax cup. And then what he does is he takes the bar out, the top bar that he's going to use in his hive, and he dips it in the wax and then he sets it down on the bar and lets it set there for a moment. And he could, I'm sure, dribble around it, but then he gives it a little twist, a little pull, and pops. Each one of the dowels come out, and all of the rows of wax cups stick to that top bar, and they're open for you to put the larvae and the royal jelly in. He has 16 of these dowels spread across the length of a Langstroth frame top to give you a perspective in even widths. So now you take that frame that have the cage over it, and you've taken the queen and you've taken that out and you set it on a bench and you use your little scooper and you scooch each one of those out and you put it inside these 16 cups. And then you want to put it in a starter hive. A cell starter is what it's referred as. So a cell starter or a cell building colony can be any colony, but it has to be strong. And a lot of times you could take a typical colony, remove the queen from it, and collapse it down to its smallest base, and it has to be loaded with bees. And what I've read, there's different techniques for this, I'll give you one. If you remove the queen and it had eggs and larvae, of course they're going to try to raise their own queen, and that's not what you want. So if any time they start to raise a queen, give them a bit, and then squish them. Without a queen in there, eventually all of the larvae and eggs will be too old for them to make more queens. Then you're going to put your queens, your potential queen thing, in the hive, and they'll make queens out of them. So the technique here was you're supposed to remove the queen one day before you graft the cells. Go in, make sure the hive is not raising its own queens. Place your grafted cells, which are in your cups, in the center of the brood nest. And anything that is ready to go in this well-nourished, overloaded with bees colony, they'll make a queen out of them. And in this case, remember, we're doing this during the time of year when the whole nectar flow and whatever is on, so we get the best food and nourishment for them. So you really don't even have to feed these. Just let them go to town. And hopefully, if you have 16 cups, they'll build you 16 queen cells. How cool would that be? So there's another method that kind of skips a step. It's called the Genter method or the Genter kit. You could buy these in a bee catalog. The way this works is you take this flat panel with a bunch of holes in it and you put it right in the middle of a brood cell, a brood frame. So you cut a hole and you put this thing in there. And it has all these holes situated where you put the cup in. And then you take your queen and you confine her in there. And instead of laying in the cell, she lays in the cup. And then you pop the cup out and put it on that 16 frame or 16 cup board. And it's the same thing. So it cuts to the chase. Yeah. Hard to describe, but no grafting needed and no cup making and whatever. You just use this Genter kit and perform the same activity. So you can't do this without thinking about the timing. So let me talk about the timing of all this. You're going through the machinations of building yourself a queen. When can you actually get a queen to work with? So on day one, the breeder lays the eggs. On day three, the eggs hatch. On day four, you harvest the larvae and you put it into your cell builder and your cups. 5, 6, 7. On day eight, those are sealed. 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. On day 14, you could put it in a mating nuke or wherever you want them to emerge, each one of the cells, because they're capped. 15, 16, the cells hatch. Now, when a queen hatches from the cell, she doesn't necessarily like hatch and then run to the entrance and fly out to go get mated. She might hang around for a while. She's the only game in town. She has to get acclimated. She has to harden and get prepped for flight. So somewhere between the time she hatches on day 16, 17, 18, 19, somewhere around 19, 20, 21, 22, she'll go out and mate. And she could make several flights, not just one. And she'll mate from 10, 15, 20, 25, maybe even more drones. So it could take 2-3 days for this to happen. So let's say she mates on queen day 22, and she comes back to the hive, 23, 24, 25, she's back, she's getting situated, she might start practicing, 26. By day 27, 28, she should be laying in earnest, and she is now the queen of the colony. So that's the timing of all this. They don't lay right away. That's one of the things. So you have to plan that into your operation. When do you want to use this queen and work backwards to when the queen eggs should be produced for you to run through your queen and mating ritual here? So I want to talk about one thing I said in the middle there, is that you take the queens out one by one and you put them in mating nukes or whatever you're going to do. There was another way that I saw that you can handle this situation. And it had to do with taking the queen and putting her in a cage. Not what you think. What they do is they cut the cup off that has the mated queen hanging and it's capped. It looks like Mr. Peanut. And they take a piece of wire and roll it in a circle to a tube. And in the top part, they stick the queen carefully down inside, and then they mount that into a hive. And of course, the bottom is capped, so the queen can't get out. But the whole point of this is they put several of these lined up next to each other on this special frame. And the queens, eventually, they'll all be fed, and they'll all be released. And inside, on this frame, you'll have 12, 16 queens. I don't think you can get all 16 in this contraption. The way it looked is they have a standard Langstroth frame, and they put a special bar across the top, and they've drilled holes, about 6 or 8 holes, and they slide this little cage down through the hole, and it holds it like a test tube holder. And so this is what happens. They put that in a cell builder or a colony, and they feed, and the queen emerges. But all the queens are captured in the little cages. Now, what do you think? Somebody asked a question about, well, can you have all these queens in the same hive? Yeah. If you think about the way this works in a swarming colony, they build a bunch of queens, and then the queens all come and find themselves and fight it out until somebody is the queen of the colony. In this case, all the queens are set up next to each other, but they're in their own contained cage and they can't get to each other, so they'd probably be perfectly fine. That's a pretty cool thing. So there's a number of ways to go about this, of course. If you're going to do the grafting where you're scooping the egg out, you need really good eyesight. Some people wear those magnifying goggles. And some people use the Genter method or other methods like cutting the cells out because they just don't have good eyesight or don't want to be bothered with that. But there's other ways to go about this. We talked about one time where it's the on-the-spot queen-rearing method. Mel Disikinen, I think that's how you say his name. That's who we covered this. The MDA splitter, if you want to look him up. Take a frame that has eggs and larvae. You don't know the age, but they're obviously young. And you take your hive tool and you create a supersedure-style presentation. You find the egg that you want, and you go with your hive tool and you knock the floor out of the bottom of that egg cell. And you might pick several spots on a frame so that you make sure you cover your bets on how old the larvae is. And if you take that frame and you put it in a queenless colony, they will use the roof of the cell to hang and create a queen cell from the roof hanging down on the face. And the way that they do this is because you've knocked the floor out. Pretty cool idea. Another thing that you can do is take a frame and just put triangle shape foundation inside. And it'll, you know, they want to build the queen cells at the bottom of a frame. So sometimes you could just cut the bottom of the frame out, but a lot of times there's wires running through it. So what people do is take a foundation and they cut these little 3-inch by 3-inch by 3-inch triangles and they put them up in there in a V shape, inverted V, so the point is facing down. And if you put that in a hive that needs queens, they'll build the queen cups on the bottom of the triangle. There's a couple other methods that I saw. I saw this tool. It looks like a long rod, and then it has something about the size of a wedding ring, my wedding ring, affixed to it on the bottom, and you heat it with a torch or a candle or something hot enough to melt wax. And you take your frame where you want to harvest and you stick this thing down through, and what you get is this tube that has the cell of the larvae that you want to use right in the middle. And this thing is the perfect size that it cuts this little tube out, and you put it in one of those cups and you hang it upside down. That's another method. That's pretty cool. To me, I've seen people cutting things with penknives and doing whatever. If you could find that tool, it makes the perfect tool to do that cup method. And that's a lot easier than grafting. You're just taking the actual cell as it got laid by the queen. I think that's a lot better than going through the machination of scooping it out, if you ask me. And the final thing is, listen, just cut the queen cells out that they make for you. This is a time of year where if you left a colony to its own devices and it's getting prepped to swarm, every once in a while you go in and look and you'll find queen cells in the hive all over the place. Get your penknife out and just cut them out and affix them into a hive. And in a couple of days, they'll hatch out and you will have new queens inside your colony. We already said that queens are sealed on day 8 and they hatch on day 16. So if you could find one that's capped, chances are you're somewhere in that window, 8 to 16, and if you put it in your hive, you can keep an eye on it. Eventually that queen will come on out. That's the easiest method, but it's not always easy to let your hive get to that state if you're not interested in that. So I always wanted to cover this topic, and I think I've gone through enough here that I'll stop. I have to talk about the timing of this in a couple other ways, right? Queens are ready to mate 5 to 7 days after they hatch. Ideally, when you're doing this, the temperatures are above 70 degrees. I mentioned earlier it's been a little cool this spring. Tough time for bees to get out. Virgin queens mate with 10 to 20 drones on one or more flights, so hopefully you have rain-free days during that week. And the good news is they'll fly out past your drones and mate with other drones somewhere in a drone congregation area. Now, if you did do all this work and then all of a sudden rain came in, don't fret. They say you have a window somewhere around 3 weeks, and hopefully you'll get some favorable days in there for the queen to go out and get mated. So I think that's enough. I will provide a link to the queen rearing methods on Michael Bush's website, the Colossus Honeybee Research Association, where it takes you through the basics of queen rearing. And I highly encourage you to go check out Raising Queen Bees, that YouTube video that I mentioned. I'll have a link to that also in the show notes. This topic I presented at our Beekeepers Association meeting this past week and shot a video of it. I'm not sure how it came out, but if it comes out and you wanted to see me present it, you can go to our YouTube channel. Or if you're later in a date or whatever and you wanted to see it again, youtube.com/NWNJBA. Look for queen rearing there. You'll find the video on that. Segment number three, I want to talk about carpenter bees. It's a common time of year where you as a beekeeper are considered all-knowing for flying yellow and black bugs, and not just honeybees, and I find myself being asked very often about carpenter bees. I thought I'd take a moment to talk about these bees and give you some insight on how to answer any questions that might come your way. The first thing to consider with the public is that they're often averse to being stung. Yep. Any bee in their face would be one that would be a threatening proposition. The thing about carpenter bees is they are often in your face if you are in any vicinity of their colony. They will swarm in and swoop you, but I'll let you in on a secret. One that will help you, but probably not make your homeowner feel any better. Most of the time when you're being buzzed, it's by the male carpenter bee, and the male, like our honeybee drones, doesn't have a stinger. They come with a very distinct feature, which helps you identify whether you are literally encountering a male. It's a yellow mark on their forehead. And the behavior that's interesting is, with them, they'll swarm around, but then they'll literally stop right in front of your face, where you'll get a good look, eye to eye, so to speak, of what they look like. And when they stand still, you can see that mark. So cool. It's my belief that carpenter bee holes are not something that carpenter bees make. They usually follow some sort of opportunity where there was a hole in a fascia board from something else, and the carpenter bee takes advantage of it. They're most active in the early spring and summer and can do some serious damage to wood structures, as their cavities can be several inches to a few feet long. Sometimes you might find them in a wood pile or somewhere on your property. And the bad news is carpenter bees have a tendency to return to their known locations, especially the nest where they originated from. Unlike some form of wasp, which are one and done as far as the nests go, the repetition of nests being used over and over again could result in a nest being reused in your home, and additional nests or growing size of dozens of holes are the result of that. So if you find yourself literally in this position, or you have a homeowner, what do you tell them? Well, you have to treat carpenter bee nests with the correct insecticides for carpenter bee control. Flying adult bees can be dispatched with a wasp spray. However, it's not going to take care of a carpenter bee infestation. And by the time the adult bees are seen in any numbers, they will already have made and provisioned several brood cavities. The grubs in these cavities will have enough food to develop into the next generation of adults and start the cycle again. So killing the bees flying around, carpenter bees, is not going to help you very much. So when you're dealing with your homeowner, you have to tell them it's necessary to do something to kill the grubs. They can't just kill the flying insects. And I'm sure there are organic, non-toxic methods to do this. And I'll talk about some of those in a second. But everything I read is that insecticide dusts are the best course of action because this, it allows the adult carpenter bees to go in and transfer that into the hive without recognizing that it's bad for them. The way it works is they travel through the dust each time they enter and exit the hive and spread it to each of the brood cells. And thus, it wipes out the adults because they get exposed to it. And it also wipes out the future generations. And everything I read, and you may not like this idea, but everything I read is the insecticide dusts are the best course of action for this because adult carpenter bees will not recognize these powders. The way you do this is you hire somebody to do it, or I guess you could do it yourself. It's done with an applicator with a long tube and a spout to inject the dust into the holes. And after the colony is eradicated, you have to plug the holes to keep future generations from using this nest. Now, I would suggest to you to avoid the notion of blocking the holes when the nest is in operation, as the grubs will stay sealed, and eventually, if they can't find their way out, they'll just bore a different hole, and it'll make your situation worse. As is often the case, the best way to get yourself out of this situation is not to have it in the first place. This is why they recommend using non-soft woods in the construction of your home and coating the wood with paint or products that would repel the carpenter bees and not allow them to bore through. So I guess the best way to end the segment, though, is to tell you that there are other ways, but I could tell you from personal experience that I didn't have a lot of luck with this. I had carpenter bees in my fascia, in the one corner of my house that we don't get to very often. And I don't know what, but the simple answer is I thought, well, I'll just block them off, I'll plug the holes, I'll do whatever. I went through the same experience where they just kept emerging, kept coming in, they'd redig out the holes, they'd make new holes. And at some point, I had screened off the area, and I had put metal over them, and they still found a way. And at some point, I ended up calling an exterminator. I just could not get rid of them. I knocked them down quite a bit, but they just kept coming back, and I, too, had to call an exterminator. I think that the carpenter bees are opportunistic. My wood is not something that's easily to bore through. And if I replace the wood, they would not go through it. But what happened in my case was that we have woodpeckers. And for whatever reason, they love to dig in the house. Now, I've always told that woodpeckers attack a house because they're after bugs that are in the wood. I don't have a termite problem or anything like that, but woodpeckers knock holes in the house all the time. We have pileated woodpeckers, you know, the woody woodpecker ones. We have other kinds, and we see them all the time. And I come out every once in a while and chase them off the house because I could hear them banging on it. And one of the things I know is if you plug the holes from the woodpeckers right away with some sort of silicone caulk, and my house is brown, and we can use this brown that just blends right in, the carpenter bees won't dig into them. But if I leave a hole, the carpenter bees will bore a hole. And actually, as I speak, there's a couple holes out in the fascia back where they always somehow seem to get in. The darn woodpeckers have done it again. But they do say that you could use these techniques that I mentioned, put screen over top of it, so the adults can't get in or out. And maybe in the winter when it's cold, leave it open and they'll die. Kill off the adults so they have less breeding going on with the spray that I mentioned earlier. Or whacking them with, you know, sometimes people take a badminton or tennis racket and whack them. But if you can cull the population down, then maybe you could break the cycle and get them out. And then plug the holes and fix them and try it. But At the end of the day, if you really get yourself in deep, call exterminator. So now you can lock into a vault that little tidbit about carpenter bees and be ready for the questions coming your way. Hope you enjoyed the segment. Not normal for me to talk about killing these critters, but when they're doing damage to your house, same advice I give about wasps and other things. If you have a wasp nest, a yellow jacket nest, or something right at your front porch or in the wood, or sometimes people talk about they're in the railing or whatever, as much as I don't like to kill any pollinators, spiders, things like that, at some point you got to take care of this stuff. You cannot have it where they swoop in every time somebody comes to your home. Think of it a lot like stink bugs if you have those. God, they're just a pain and you want to get rid of them. Carpenter bees that are buzzing you and doing whatever and causing structural damage, you're going to have to do something about it. And it's a good idea to know what to do about it on your own. So it's time to run into the roundtable section. This is the back of the book. Just a couple smattering of topics. The first one I want to talk about is a hive monitoring system. I've mentioned this before. Our association is looking at purchasing a system. This is very similar to the maker DIY movement where a lot of people are instrumenting their hives. I saw a lot more this year of people doing FLIR images and temperature controls, and you're starting to see some things like the Broodminder out there. Electric hive monitoring will measure a bunch of different facets. Temperature of the hive, rainfall, wind, humidity, hive weight, hive acoustics, bees coming and going. And depending on the system that you purchase, you can access all this information by going in and reading a sensor at your hive, or in the case of the systems we're looking at, it comes with a gateway, which is synonymous to like a cell phone that reports back and connects to the hive and sends the information up to the cloud, where you can access it through a dashboard. The system we're looking at comes complete with a weather system, a weather station, scales, and all the sensors you need to collect the data that we were talking about. J. David Waldman, the person I interviewed a couple episodes back, has been doing the research for our association and gave a report at our recent meeting of the system, which is Arnia that we're looking at. The thing that we like about it is multiple users can observe the hive activity. And so the whole point of this is the entire association benefits from the purchase. And we're also looking to build a roadmap for other associations in the state that they can get their own systems and we can have a network of hive information. Couple that with the swarm report data and you might get even more information about how to manage your bees. What's interesting about the systems is if you know how to read the data and you get a sense of what it can do for you, you could figure out whether you're queen right. You could figure out if a swarm is imminent or a swarm has issued, any hive weight, loss, gain, things like that. You can get a sense of how your hive is developing coming out of winter or ramping down, depending on the dearths or winter arriving. You can determine if your hive is being robbed, because it's going to lose a lot of weight relatively quickly. You can even tell if your hive's been stolen or toppled over with these sensors. And I suppose if you get to know them, you could find even more information out about it as you go along. So we held a vote at our previous meeting and voted to purchase these. There wasn't a large set of memberships, so we're going to, because the purchase price is high enough, it requires a full membership vote. And we're going to send a note out to our membership just saying that we did authorize the purchases for this amount of money. And we're going to ask everybody to weigh in here just in case. We don't want to get ourselves in trouble. And as the president of the association, I think it's just good karma to make sure when you're spending this amount of money for all the work we do at the fairs and other situations to raise some money, I think everybody should have a say in how it gets spent. The good news is this is completely and utterly to our charter of providing information and well-being to our members about our colonies and how to manage it. So I think this is not a difficult one to argue for. Out of respect for the provider, I don't know whether they have open pricing to everybody. We know what we've been quoted, and I'm not going to give the quote price. If you want to, you can contact Arnia or any of the other systems and see if they'll give you quotes. But we were buying a full system with the gateway, the battery, the solar power, and everything, and it runs north of $1,000. So, and this includes a data plan. It does not include the subsequent years, which is an additional fee. But again, if you break down the full cost of this system per the members that we have, it breaks out pretty evenly and becomes a smaller cost that way when you take that perspective on it. So pretty excited about this. Hopefully within the next couple weeks, we will be authorizing that purchase. And of course, when the data comes online, we'll let you know about it. If you wanted to know more about the system we're looking at, it's Arnia Remote Beehive Monitoring System. The website is www.arnia.co.uk. You can check out their products, how it works, and read any frequently asked questions about the systems that we've been looking at. It gives you screenshots of what the system looks like. It shows you what the scale looks like and other parts and pieces. And one of the things that David found in his research, and he looked at a number of kits. He looked at homemade kits, semi-homemade kits, professional kits, and these systems. And, you know, you want to consider the price, the connectivity. Do you have to go to the yard? In the case of our mentoring yards, our hives are, you know, they're in a field. They're not something somebody is seeing every single day. So having negated the need to have to go to the hives is important for us. The thing about this is that it's pretty easy to set up this particular system, which was another consideration, and they have good support and maintenance. So we've been told, and they're partners with the Bee Inform partnership. And there's just a lot of good positives on this particular system that we're taking a look at. So arnia.co.uk is the website. You could check that out. Roundtable number two, wanted to talk about a swarm capture. Got a phone call on Friday night, just before I was heading out, about a swarm in a tree and a swarm in a bush on the same property. Came by way of the swarm listing page on the New Jersey Beekeepers Association, so thanks for that. Went out Saturday morning. Prepped everything Friday night and early. And to the point, I remember that I recorded the experience in an audio format. I just took my phone and recorded getting prepped, driving there, my notions, my thoughts. And I'll have to put that recording together and release it as a sidebar here, because I think it was interesting. Also shot a little video of the actual swarm. So I drove to the homeowner's house, pulled in the driveway, and found out that the big swarm, which was hanging in a tree, had departed that night, shortly after he called me, but the other one was still in the bush. And the swarm was so big that it had toppled over the branches of this little boxwood or yew or whatever it was, and they were laying on the ground proper. So I was able to take a pair of cutters and cut a couple of the twigs and lift big gobs of bees and set them into the hive. I'll produce a video and you'll be able to see it. But once I did all that, there were still probably 5,000-6,000, a pound, 2 pounds of bees laying on the ground. I had to figure out how I was going to scoop them up and put them inside the hive. And I got the idea. I had the hive all sealed. I had taped it all up. I untaped the entrance and left it open and covered the box and set it right on the ground. And the bees inside, making noise and fanning, encouraged all the bees on the ground to walk right into the hive. I shot a video of that too, of course. It was really cool. All the time I'm talking to the homeowner, who was deathly afraid. And I tried to talk him into putting a suit on and coming over, but he just was having nothing. And every time I'd walk over or be next to him and a bee would swoop by, he'd duck. And, you know, I empathize with people who have no tolerance whatsoever for a bee flying by. He was absolutely didn't want anything to do with it. But he did stand there with his camera and take pictures of me and was in amazement that I stood there. So he asked me if I got stung. When I took the clippers and went to clip the one branch, it was hard, and then it went quick. And when I pinched the clippers closed, I touched my finger, my middle finger to my thumb and squished a bee, and it stung me underneath the fingernail. God, I hate that type of sting. That's the only sting I took, and it was from my own doing. So I put it all in a box. I got as many bees as possible. I took my time, and I let them recollect, and I tried to do what I could. I bet I left half a cup of bees there, but I got all the rest of them, sealed them up, and drove them over and put them on the farm. I went and checked them this afternoon, and what was interesting is that whole hive, all the bees were out. There were bees on the front, and there were tons of bees orienting. It rained really hard last night. And it rained into the morning, and then it broke. And this was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was typical, you see this every once in a while, where you see a large number of bees exit the hive, and they fly orientation flights. A lot of the young bees, you'll see that happen in the early spring, early summer. Well, this was this hive getting oriented and a lot of the bees out. It did not look like they were absconding, but of course I could go back and they would be gone. But I think they made residence in there, and hopefully I got the queen and everything's good to go. So added another hive to the stable, and I think I'm going to leave them be. I'm not going to touch them for a couple days. And sometime Thursday, Friday, maybe Saturday, over the holiday weekend coming up here, I'll go put a feeder on and I'll feed them. I want to get them built up as much as I can. So, first swarm collection of the year, and yes, I checked my swarm boxes, but nothing in them yet. How about that? So, pretty happy about that. They look like a good, they were at least as big as a package, maybe a little bit bigger, I think. So, good. You know, this is the time of year, we're getting to the end of May, where if you don't get a hive started with a package or a swarm, they're not going to make it unless you feed and prop them up. I know that's not universal. People talk about it. But, my experience has been swarms that you capture in June, July, they don't do very well getting through to winter, mostly because you have to feed them in the dearth. And, yeah, okay. Anyway, swarm in a box, good. Like it. Roundtable number 3, the New Jersey Swarm Report. 3 letters. W-O-W. Yeah. 254 swarms reported so far this spring. That's awesome. I love it. In previous years, our numbers were not that high. And I am really excited that the swarms had done so much better this year in reporting. Probably some of it had to do with our spring meeting where we did a lot of promotion of it. But in 2014, when we started this, we had 143. In 2016, we had 106. Went down a little bit. And thus far, rolling into May, and usually people report swarms through to July, we have 254. So the word is out. And people are reporting their swarms, and I'm pretty excited about that. NJSwarm.com, if you want to see the data. I haven't been up there recently because I've been ridiculously busy. But by the night's end, tonight, I will post the information about the swarm report after I post the podcast. So you can go check that out and keep up to date there. And to all those who reported swarms, thank you very much. That is great. We're working with William Patterson University right now, and Dr. David Gilley, I mentioned him before. He's going to be presenting our swarm data at EAS as part of the study he's doing. with our data, and I bet they're going to be thrilled to death to see that the swarm report people are taking the time to report. He's able to use the data by zip code and draw a bunch of inferences on it, and he's trying to map them to grow degree days and also see whether or not a typical calendar periods can predict swarming in New Jersey. And what's great about this is the more swarms and the more data we collect over the years, the better we will be. And I was really concerned last year that the numbers kind of dropped down. I'm happy to see that people are supporting us this year. And I think if we get a good number of years worth of data, swarming in New Jersey will become more predictable to us. So I really do appreciate that people are reporting. And the data looks great this year. Pretty exciting. Roundtable number four. This one is, it comes from Imgur. I-M-G-U-R. It's Imgur, I think it's supposed to be. My son Danny sent this over. It's nothing more than a picture of a hive on a stand, but the hive is really, really cool looking. What the person did was they painted the hive in different colors, and the color combination is freaking cool. It looks like it's stained natural wood, and I'll describe it. They have three boxes on the hive. On the bottom box, both sides are this real blonde-looking, shellacked, beautiful wood finish. On the front is a dark, almost black-brown mahogany. And what's neat is, in combination, the front and the sides are mixed. And when you take the rabbits and you put them together, it makes this really neat pattern. And the way that they design the hive is they have black on the front, blonde on the side. The second box has blonde on the front and brown on the side. And then the third box had black on the front and blonde on the side. So it looks like a checkerboard effect. And the roof is one of those garden hive roofs with a tapered. And the wood all the way around is the same black-brown stain or finish. And the hive just looks great. I know difficult to describe, but I will send a message or post a picture of this on the blog. I don't even know where it comes from. I just have the image, but really cool idea. Very, very cool effect. Take a look at it. Roundtable number five, last one for the episode. This one's called Fit for Life. Came across a article post in June 2015 American Bee Journal. It's written by William Blomstead about the back of a beekeeper. It goes through his trials and tribulations of seeing how he exercises and stretches, because we all know that beekeeping, lifting boxes, is a challenge, especially on your back. For me, I call this Fit for Life because, well, you know, I'm getting up there, folks. And I've had this notion for a while. I walk and I do other exercises. Sometimes I lift weights on my Bowflex. I've been way too freaking busy lately to exercise properly. And what I want to do is get this exercise routine that I can do. No weights, no any, could be raining, doesn't matter, and I could do this. And ironically enough, I see the exercises that he has in here. They're stretching, there's some sort of yoga poses and so on. They're fine. I'm talking about the American Bee Journal one. But I'm looking for something a little bit different. I want to do something focused on my core. And I want to do something to build a little strength and flexibility in a different manner. And Fit for Life, I found an article, don't laugh, in AARP magazine. And the point of this is it gives you 8 smart moves that can help you stay strong and healthy. And I like the approach. What they did was, they broke these exercises that they gave you, which are similar to calisthenics and that type of thing, but based on an activity that you do either around the house or in your life. Let me give you an example. Number one in around the house is loading and unloading the dishwasher. So, you know, that's a job where you bent over and you're not carrying a lot of weights, but The way that they do it is they show you how to do something called the hip hinge. From a standing position, you let your butt go down and you put your arms up and you do that over and over again. I could do that anywhere, at work, upstairs right now. I could stand up and do it. Next one is taking in the groceries. It's a squat, lift, and carry. These involve having a couple weights, but basically you're standing up and you squat down till your legs are horizontal with the ground, and then you come back up and you have weights in your hand, and then you move forward as you come back up, like take a lunge forward. The next one is vacuuming, and this is a lunge and reach. So you're standing with both your feet, you lunge forward with one arm or with one leg till it's horizontal to the ground, your thigh, and you take your other hand on the far side for balance and you put it straight out. And you just keep swapping that move back and forth. Now the next one is, and I don't have any grandkids, but weekend with the grandkids, getting up off the floor. It's like a modified push-up, but you're on your knees. You do a stationary diagonal lunge as another one where you're standing with your hand on a chair or something and you go down and you drop your leg. Look, I'm not going to go through all these. I'm probably boring you to death. But the premise of it, and I'll go through a couple more, is putting a child into a car seat and they show you a turn with a heavy weight, a medicine ball or something like that. Putting luggage into an overhead bin and stair climbing. These couple short exercises are what I'm looking for. Something that will strengthen my core. Something like doing squats and burpees and all these things that I hear people doing. But something that I can get used to and do for a repetition over a period of time that I just do these every day. I'll let you in on a little secret. I don't normally do them, but I have been doing push-ups lately. And it goes back to something the doctor told me, which is, I don't talk about this. I don't care to talk about it. You may have noticed if you looked at my videos, but I've been focused on losing weight. And I've lost a considerable amount of weight since last year. And I'm still working on that, trying to go down. But now what I want to do is build my muscular physique, because muscles build more burn more calories and keep you fitter and give you a better metabolism. And that's what I'm working on. So working in these exercises in my off period also helps me get a stronger core, stronger back. And in the end, as much as I don't do beekeeping for a living, I don't like being out of shape and doing that. So I think this will help immensely. So recently I took a course and it talks about 66 days to develop a habit. To me, I have to get started on the habit. So the first thing I'm doing is researching which exercises I want to do. That's why I cut this little article out of the AARP magazine. And when I get them, I am going to set the challenge and start going for 66 days and keep track of it. No, I don't think I'm going to start a blog or anything. But I might let you know. And I might tell you what exercises. And maybe we together can all have fun doing this challenge. We'll see. So the exercises I spoke of came from the April-May 2016 edition of AARP magazine. You can look for the article Fit for Life on page number 44. And my guess is it's probably up on the web somewhere. It has a picture of a handsome young man talking to a little girl playing on the floor as part of the feature article. So looking at the time, I guess it's time to wrap things up. Couple odds and ends to cover. You know, I typically see my podcast reviews that come in for iTunes, and I do encourage you, if you're an iTunes listener, to rate us. It helps people to find us. And I also get fresh perspective from things. As an example, this one just came through recently. I just got tired of the misinformation and bias. After being a subscriber for a long time, I finally deleted and unsubscribed to this podcast. The delivery has always been similar to NPR, as in very good to put you asleep. I've listened all this time for the sheer reason that I believe in getting multiple perspectives on anything I do. However, I just got tired of the constant propaganda, this guy might as well be a mouthpiece for Big Ag and the chemical companies. If you believe in the natural way, don't bother with this guy. 1 star. Hey, good. I'm okay with that. I know there's times when I come across that way. And you know what? Look, nope, I'm not going to comment on that. I'm good with that. I want people to speak their mind and say what they want to say, because I know varying perspectives are what they are in this world. And I do appreciate the fact that the person gave me feedback, and it will give me food for thought. Can't change what I said in this episode, though, huh? You know, I said recently, and it's true, that this has been one of the busiest periods of life for me personally that I've had in a long time. Long days at work, and by example, Monday night, school concert for my son, hustled home. Tuesday night, I worked till 8:45 p.m. after a 6-something start. Had dinner at 9:30, which I don't particularly like. Wednesday night, soccer practice. Thursday night, second school concert. This one for orchestra band. And Friday night was a beekeeping meeting, and well, you get the picture. It's been busy nights. I'm also working on a project here at home, trying to get it finished up. And life has been ridiculously busy, more so than ever I can remember. The bad news is I don't know when I could get back to record the next episode unless it happens next weekend, which I'm not sure that I'm going to find the window for it. The truth is I'm traveling for work almost all through June. I'm going to India in the beginning of June for a number of days. And then I am not coming home. I'm flying from India to Seattle. I'm going out to a conference in the Microsoft Redmond area. And then I'll get home. I'll be home for about a week or so. Maybe, I think, 4 or 5 days. And then I'm flying to one of our manufacturing plants in Italy for a number of days. And then I'm coming home. And then I have another 2 trips scheduled in July for various reasons. So it's going to be a tough June and July for getting episodes out. I do think that I could probably sneak in an episode for something I have recorded, an interview I have in the can, and a couple other things. So I'll try to make sure that there's not a long period, but it's predicated on my ability to post some stuff from afar. And I'm doing all that I can in the time that I have left before I leave to get that stuff prepped so we can keep the show running as it is. So listen, if you're a constant listener, I know it is terrible to wait 3 weeks for an episode. Sorry. I will do my best to keep filling in the gaps. And if you don't hear from me in June, you'll know why. I'm going to do my best to get an episode prepped and ready to go and posted from India, if I could swing that. I'm going to visit a couple technology companies that work for us that are my vendor partners. So given their technology partners, I'm imagining I can do this from there. So we'll see. They're going to accommodate me, and looking forward to that. So anyway, that's all the news that is fit for print. I guess it's time to wrap things up on this episode. I know that several of you have written in. I'm sorry, I just haven't gotten to read any emails lately and have the ability to comment. I've read them. Thank you for sending them in. I'm not going to be able to do listener mail for this episode. There was one they read in with some comments about the David Waldman interview, saying how much they appreciated it. And I appreciated that comment. That was really heartfelt, and just wanted to say to the person who wrote in, thank you. That really helps me. I strive to not get in the way of interviews, and I thought David did a great job at expressing what he had going on, and he was just a natural interview. And so I was really happy with that effort, and I think a couple that I have coming up are going to be just as good. So thanks for writing in, and Joe Lewis and others, I'll get to your emails. I'm in that rambling state of mind sitting here looking at a late hour, so I guess I'll wrap it up. I'll be back soon, everybody. Hang in there with me. And I'll leave you what I always leave you with. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.